We move to the final case today, U.S. versus Creighton.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. While I was preparing this case for trial at the district court level in the months of November and December, a case out of the Seventh Circuit Supreme Court came out called U.S. v. Krieger, which seemed to be on point with the proposition that if there are mandatory minimum sentences set that do not exceed the statutory maximum sentence that is set, then there is no Sixth Amendment violation. And it seems to be appropriate that that would be my case. I was surprised on two fronts about this case. The first thing I thought that would happen was that the United States government would dismiss the case, do a superseding indictment, and just bring a charge of delivering of heroin in this particular case, and then let us fight over the sentencing allegation at the sentencing component of the sentence if he was confirmed guilty at the jury trial. Parenthetically, my second approach was I was not sure that the Seventh Circuit would actually want to hear this case, given that they've already made this decision. I sent a letter to the court indicating that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be having a review of the case next week. I've read all the amicus briefs, as well as all the petitions, and I think all of the documents are there for the Supreme Court to take up U.S. v. Krieger. In any event, I was pleasantly surprised, though, that the U.S. attorney decided not to change the elements of the case and use the resulting in death as an element and not as a sentencing factor, and thus we had to put it in front of the jury for them to make the decision as to whether death resulted would be applied to my client or not. As the court is well aware, this will raise the mandatory minimum sentence from 0 to 20 with no mandatory minimum to a minimum sentence of 20 years to life. So it would be a massive increase in the sentence. At the jury trial, there was a hung jury on the second component of this, whether death resulted. And thus, if one was to look at the sentencing guidelines, the advisory sentencing guidelines, my client had a level 22 and was in a criminal history category 4, which I don't have the numbers in front of me here, Your Honors, but it would be somewhere in the 6 to 7, maybe 8-year range is where he got. However, Judge Crabb, after going over the same situation as the judge in the Krieger decision, came to a conclusion that she would have to sentence him to 20 years and that she had no other alternative but to do that. My argument...
That's based on her looking at it, preponderance of the evidence, that it was his heroin that caused the death.
That is correct. She sat and listened to the evidence during the trial, and she came to the conclusion that the heroin that was used was sold by my client to another individual, and that individual gave the drugs to the young lady who ended up having the overdose of the drugs.
Why was it necessary to give a special verdict form given this situation?
I argued against a special verdict. I had thought that we should just have it as a verdict. It was the government's position that in their that this is how they do apprende type arguments as special verdicts, and that's how the Western District of Wisconsin has been responding to these, and so the judge went along with it for a special verdict.
So it's kind of a localized solution or attempt to solve that apprendi.
Right. I think the position would be if he was acquitted of the actual distribution, then that he would have to be acquitted, or maybe he would not even go to the special verdict. But we knew that wasn't going to happen because during the closing arguments, we admitted that there was heroin sold. We were of the opinion that there were two sources of heroin. One could have come from my client. One could have come from Dominic Becerra and the government's star witness, Mr. Krugel. And that actually dovetail into my second argument on the hearsay argument and really what is truthfulness. But I did want to finish up on this argument because I know many, many of these issues are right. The Castile factors that this court went through to determine whether it was a sentencing factor or an element, and the Harris court and the McMillan court and the decision, does Apprendi overrule these cases? What Justice Breyer said in the Harris case and what this court said, that this is all just being held on by a string. It seems to me that the court is moving in a direction, the Supreme Court is moving in a direction that will eventually say that mandatory minimums will ultimately affect sentences under Apprendi as well as maximum sentence. Now, that's just me speculating, Your Honors. I'm not trying to say anything, but from reading in between the lines and reading what experts have to say in regards to all of this, I find that there is not a significant difference between 0 to 20, which is what 841 would have for a penalty B, 841B, which would be the penalty phase, and 841BC, which is death resulting, which raises the mandatory, which raises the sentence of the mandatory minimum to 20 years to life. I think that my argument that the government shouldn't have two bites of the same apple is something that dovetails back to the focus of the argument of whether Harris and O'Brien cases that have to do with guns brandishing and owning a machine gun, whether those are going to be applicable under Apprendi in the future, and whether that decision happens within this term or not. I think that that the split in the circuits that are currently in existence are something that are important. If you are charged with this crime resulting in death and you are in the First Circuit, the Second Circuit, or the Ninth Circuit, you're going to get a sentence somewhere between 2.5 and 5 years if you are not convicted of the death resulting component of this. But if you're in other circuits, for example, the Seventh Circuit, and as we know from Mr. Creighton, my client, and Ms. Krieger for the fentanyl patch, that you're going to get a sentence of 20 years where they cross and kind of tie the judge's hands behind their back because they have no alternative but to sentence them to 20 years. And so I think that under an appropriate analysis of Castile and O'Brien and the five factors, and I thought the court did an excellent job in Krieger, but I think that I just would have come to a different conclusion in it.
Right. Into your rebuttal time, just thought.
I'm into my rebuttal. I think I want to talk briefly about, I'm not sure why, but about my hearsay argument on my rebuttal. I would just say briefly right now, Judge, that by not being able to bring in statements, hearsay statements, I was not able to pursue the theory of my defense, and I'll use the rest of my rebuttal for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Reinhart?
Thank you. David Reinhart for the United States. As mentioned, this defendant's position is foreclosed by this court's decision in United States versus Krieger. Mandatory minimum sentences don't violate Apprendi as long as they don't exceed the statutory maximum sentence. And specifically, this court held that death-resulting enhancement is a sentencing factor, not an element, a factor which the judge can't prove by a preponderance of the evidence at sentencing. This case is really indistinguishable from Krieger. I don't think revisiting Krieger will do any good because this court is bound by the Supreme Court authority in Harris and McMillan. So I don't think that's an avenue that this court should go down. I don't know if the Supreme Court is moving in the direction of mandatory minimums falling under Apprendi. I think, given the makeup of the court, I don't think that it is moving that direction. As far as the two bites,
it's up for. Is it going to be Monday when the Supreme Court?
It's up for, I believe, a decision on whether
so
they
will know, at least
hear the case,
whether or not they're going to take it.
That's correct.
Obviously, if they take the case, we probably need to what.
Well, if they take the case, I guess they'll decide whether there's mandatory.
Well, I suppose we'd have to hold up on this one then.
Yes. I don't know how long the process will be from there, but
if they take the case, it takes only four to take the case. So
correct.
We'll see.
Correct. As far as the two bites of the same apple argument, it's well established that this court can consider relevant conduct, even conduct which a defendant is acquitted of. I think it would be illogical to include acquitted conduct as relevant conduct, but not conduct that resulted from a...
I guess it gets back to my question that I asked your opposing counsel. Why were you asking for a special verdict on the...
That would increase, the special verdict would increase the statutory maximum. It would have gone then from 20 to life as opposed to, without the special verdict, it would have been 0 to 20.
Okay.
And, just like drug quantity, we have to put those factors forward. Finally, as far as the statement against interest, the district court did properly preclude Dominic Becerra's statement because it didn't meet the requirements of a statement against interest. As the district court found, it wasn't trustworthy. It didn't have corroborating circumstances. The actual declarant had contradicted himself on another statement, and the declarant's testimony wasn't supported by the rest of the evidence in the case. Even if there was error in regards to that particular hearsay question, it would be harmless because the jury never reached a verdict on the death resulting portion of the case. I will sit down if there aren't any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The issue I want to bring up with the court is that there is no dispute that Dominic Becerra was unavailable. He ingested on his own fentanyl, which is somewhat ironic given the Krieger case, and was unable to form any thoughts whatsoever, just a horrible drug. We put him on the stand. He wasn't able to remember, wasn't able to do any type of questions. And so we also know that his statements were against his penal interest. He was doing heroin with the government's main witness, Mr. Krugel. So we know that that's there. The question is, was it trustworthy? Well, my argument for trustworthy, and I know that abuse of discretion is a very difficult hurdle to overcome, but that he talked to the police officer first. It was two police officers that they talked to, and the reports were the same. Primacy alone would allow his first statement to have a little bit more credibility than after speaking with Mr. Krugel, who we know from the facts of the case concocted some story in order to keep him and all these people out of any type of involvement in this kind of death. And these are the type of people that we have to deal with down in the dirt, down in the trenches, day in and day out. And if the jury doesn't believe that they're truthworthy, then that's one thing. Mr. Reinhart could bring in his statement that he made 10 days later, and then the jury could compare the two and say, well, which one would we believe? My argument would be that it's his first statement to the police, first statement to two police. He has no reason to lie, no reason to embellish. He's trying to get the best deal he can possible, knows that he's in a lot of trouble, and it isn't until the second one that he changes his story. So I think that this is a perfect example of trying to establish that someone is not trustworthy. And so I would just leave that with the court right now. And without any questions, I thank you very much for taking this time. Thank
you. Counsel, you took this case by appointment of the court?
I did, Judge.
Thank you very much.
It was for the trial and the appeal.
Trial and the appeal.
Trial and the appeal. Well, you have the thanks of the court for both.
And the sympathy as well.
Yeah, I need the sympathy. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess.